It's not a controversial statement to say that we live in an in-demand culture. From TV shows and movies and music to food and sex and information, stuff has never been more available, faster, and with less effort. If you don't want to cook, you can eat out. If you don't want to read, you can spark note it. If you don't want to talk to someone, you can at least Facebook stalk them. In such a culture, the line at the DMV is like a prehistoric exhibit. Dial-up internet is like a cruel joke that used to be worth it to listen to those obnoxious noises in order to get on AIM after school. Yeah, come on. We think in 4G, we speak in 140 characters, we look through the lens of Instagram at life. We just don't like waiting. In a town where a train runs through the center, it doesn't take much to convince us of that. We don't like waiting. Ah, the train. Advertisers have been all over that for a long time now, of course. Whether you want firm abs and 10 easy workouts, saw that at the dentist yesterday, magazine. Whether you want mental health through repeating a simple mantra, or whether you want 15% off your car insurance in 15 minutes or less. There's someone willing to pitch it to you, right? And we don't need much persuading. But this is much more than an American or just a Western problem. This is a human problem. As much of an on-demand culture we have, and as much as that spurs us on to hate waiting, it had no part in creating the issue. Our opposition to waiting runs far deeper than the onrush of technology or an advertising campaign. And I know that because the Bible is full of people who struggled with waiting. Think of Abraham. At 75 years old, God comes to him and says, "You know what? I'm going to give you who are as good as dead, and your wife, who's past the age of childbearing, a kid." It was going to take 25 years. Abraham didn't know that. He struggled to wait, so much so that he resorted to sleeping with his Egyptian servant, Hagar, in order to kind of fast forward the process. Or the Israelites at the foot of Mount Sinai. Moses goes up on the mountain. Where'd that Moses guy go? They got tired of waiting, made a calf statue, fell down and worshiped that instead. The psalmist's cry, "How long, O Lord, must I wait?" runs throughout the Bible in many different words and actions as people sat waiting for what seemed like forever. Waiting isn't easy for us, but it wasn't easy for them either. And yet we read of how God continually called people to wait. He is the God who works for those who wait for him. And as we'll soon see, that call to wait is at the heart of our passage tonight. Wait is the message we're going to hear from Solomon and his bride. Wait for intimacy. Wait for sex. Wait for the kind of unrestrained, unquenchable passion that ought to characterize romance. But hear this. Our passage is no cautionary tale or some fear-mongering abstinence program. It's an invitation to the kind of fullness and abundant life that only comes from walking in the design of our Creator. And to that end, we're going to find help in three areas. One, what is it we're waiting for? Two, why are we waiting? Three, who's telling us to wait? For anyone who's new tonight, we've been focusing this semester on the Song of Solomon, which is an extended love song in the Old Testament. It was probably written by Solomon, the king of Israel at the time. And there are really three main characters. There's Solomon, the king. There's his bride, a Shulamite woman. And there's this chorus of onlookers, this kind of like just group of gals who are maybe the same stage of life as this woman who's marrying the king. And they're her friends. They're people who live in the same area. The basic gist of it is it's a song of celebration. Celebration of romance and intimacy through the experience of two lovers. The song tells of their first meeting, their developing courtship and intimacy, their marriage, struggles with that afterward, the consummation of that marriage and eventually where the relationship goes from there and how it deepens. And as we saw last week, the song goes from 0 to 60 in one verse, right? Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. First words in the Song of Solomon, for your love is better than wine. The song begins in the raptures of adoration, and those notes carry it through the whole thing. Along with expressing her love for the king, the woman, she speaks first. She talks about her yearning to be with him, but she also raises an insecurity. One of the keenest things she feels about herself, where she doesn't measure up to the cultural standard of beauty, and this is a shocking thing for us, right? Because it's the opposite of our cultural standard. She didn't like that she was tan, and other people didn't either. They kind of looked down on her for that. Pale skin was in, all right? She would look, yeah, Eric, nice. That wasn't a dig, he went like this. Anyway. You couldn't see it. And so she knows. She knows she doesn't measure up to this cultural standard of beauty where pale skin showed that you were wealthy enough to not have to work outside. And she's insecure about that. But she knows enough to know that she is loved by the king. And so she still yearns to be with him, and she expresses that desire. So we left off last week right before the king responds. And that's what we're going to read tonight. So if you open up to Song of Solomon, chapter 1. This is basically right in the middle of your Bible, if you aren't familiar. And we'll be reading verses 1:8 to 2:7. Song of Solomon 1:8 to 2:7, I am going to try not to blush. If you do not know, O most beautiful among women, follow in the tracks of the flock. So she's just asked, where can I find you? He answers her in this way. And pasture your young goats beside the shepherd's tents. I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make for you ornaments of gold studded with silver, say the others. And she responds, while the king was on his couch, my nard gave forth its fragrance. My beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves, he says. And then she responds, behold, you are beautiful, my beloved, truly delightful. Our couch is green, the beams of our house are cedar, our rafters are pine. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. He responds, a lily among brambles, so is my love among the young women. And she closes out the section. As an apple tree among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. With great delight, I sat in his shadow, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am sick with love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Here's the big idea of the passage we just read. Love is to be a feast of unquenchable passion prepared by uncompromised purity. Love is to be a feast of unquenchable passion prepared by uncompromised purity. The passion expressed by the lovers answers the first question that will help in that call in 2 verse 7, to wait, to not stir up love until it pleases. What is it we're waiting for? We're waiting for the type of unquenchable passion that the lovers display here. Have you ever been in a situation where you feel like you're hearing something that's just a little too personal for you to hear? Reading this is kind of like going to a restaurant where you sit down next to that couple who's like decided they're going to sit on the same side of the booth, And they're talking to each other, and they're just so taken with each other that they don't really care who overhears them. In fact, they want people to overhear them. They want people to know how much of a catch they got. Like we would expect from that kind of couple, most of their conversation is a back and forth interaction of mutual attraction and admiration. It's kind of like when a couple saying to each other, like, no, I love you more, no, I love you more, except it's just way more creative. They're doing metaphors and similes all over the place. It's like they're looking around and racking their brain of past experience to think of what are the most beautiful things, what are the best things in my experience that I can compare my beloved to. And they say, you know, the best thing about this, that's kind of what you're like. And all of these things, you embody them, and it's still not quite sufficient. Sometimes he just has to say, you're beautiful. No simile anymore. You embody the best of all these things. This is romantic one-upsmanship of the best kind. The first thing the king says in response is to his bride's insecurity. Oh, most beautiful among women, is what he calls her. He knows that she falls outside the cultural standard of beauty and that others have looked down on her for it. He knows that this is the place where her insecurity is keenest. He knows that further intimacy is only going to go so far if she really believes that he loves her and finds her beautiful. And so he tackles this issue up front. For the king, the unchanging standards of biblical character were more important than the fleeting standards of cultural beauty. Seeing the character of this woman allowed him to see outside the bonds of a preset cultural mold and to notice her true loveliness. He finds her gorgeous, even though she is not what the culture would say is gorgeous. The king goes on in verse 9 to get more specific. Why is she the most beautiful among women to him? I compare you, my love, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots. Now saying, you know, honey, you're like a laboring horse. It's not gonna resonate with most women today, but that probably brought a flush of delight to her. In that time, mares weren't used to pull chariots. Stallions were. And so he's kind of saying, like, it's like you're the only woman in a crowd of men. That's how desirable you are to me. You're as desirable to me now as if you were the last woman on earth. Even though there are tons of women, that's how much I want you, and I'm amazed that no other guys have gone after you. This description could also point to the fact that she was more than just a pretty face, that she was useful, she was hardworking, she was diligent, she could come alongside him in his labor. This woman had the whole package for him. He wanted all of her character, her passions, her gifts, and her beauty. And in light of all the king has said, the chorus of onlookers in verse 11 can't help but agree. They rejoice in the love of their friends, and they want to see it flourish. Instead of seeing something they didn't have and being filled with envy and bitterness, they saw the beauty of the lovers' affection for each other, and they came alongside the couple in any way they could. It's a good way to treat your friends who are in relationships, even if you're not. In addition to exhausting their language to compliment each other, the lovers are also exhausting their senses. Touch, sight, smell, taste. The couple describes the romance in this passage with every sense except for hearing. In the next couple of verses, the smell the bride describes is representative of total attraction. Character, handsomeness, all of it. That's what she means when she says, my beloved is to me a sachet of myrrh that lies between my breasts. Myrrh is a pleasant-smelling gum. And she's saying that his attractiveness is like a pouch of myrrh that she hangs on a necklace and puts around her. It's like the smell is just constantly wafting up. Even when she's not with him, her attitude toward him is the same. It's not like one of those situations where she's with him and he woos her and she falls in love with him, and then when she's away and she's thinking a little bit more, she's like, man, I don't know if this guy's right. But then she gets back and she's like, oh, I fell in love with him again. No, she's like, wherever she is, even when she's gone and away from him, his attractiveness, what he has said and done, has such an indelible, impressive impression on her that it stays with her and it's constant. Whether they're together or apart, her opinion is the same. She then goes on to say he's like a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi, which was an oasis by the Dead Sea. Though the world is full of turmoil and pressure, though others who fit the cultural standard look down upon her, he is like a refuge to her. He's a place where she can come and she can breathe a sigh of relief. He invigorates her and enlivens her and spurs her on to endurance. She comes in with weighted shoulders and she goes out feeling freer. This is something to look for in someone you're interested in. Do you walk away from spending time with this person feeling more alive, more like the person God made you to be, and living in your identity as a Christ follower? Do they bring out the best in you, or does it feel like they tear you down and misunderstand? So after a brief reciprocating remark from him, your eyes are doves. You are beautiful, my love. You are beautiful. She then compares the forest of the trees and the grass of the forest to their house. So not only does she say that he is an entire world to her, right? I don't have to go to En-Gedi to get the feeling that smelling those henna blossoms gives me. All I have to do is spend time with you, she says. I don't have to travel the world to get the feeling of all these different exotic places. I just need to talk with you and spend time with you. He's a whole world to her. Not only that, but wherever they are, she's going to feel at home because she's with him. So whether they're in his palace, his actual home, or whether they're in the forest, it's going to feel like a palace to her. They can be in the forest, and it'll feel just like the comfort of their own home. The imagery in this description has an echo of Eden to it. Do you see it? Here are two lovers in nature, right? Engaging together as a lord and lady over creation and the beautiful romance that God made them for. They are laying themselves bare, and they are without shame. Human love has the capability of doing that. It can give us a brief taste of what paradise in Eden was like, a brief echo, like a forgotten memory. God is whispering to us in those moments, because it's not only with human love is a big one, but in the best moments of life, when you feel like you get a taste of like, this is what the world ought to be about. This is showing me that some sort of satisfaction is available beyond my normal everyday experience. That's God whispering to us, telling us that there's something that has been dearly lost and that it's possible to be regained through Jesus. Tragically, when we experience this taste of the divine in human love, when we get those snatches of, man, my soul has a gaping hole in it and something needs to satisfy it, we so often, our natural response is to try to find that in the thing where we found the whisper. So we think, this love gave me a snapshot, a whisper, an echo of the divine. I'm going to try and find my ultimate satisfaction in it. Instead of seeing it as like a breadcrumb meant to lead us on to God, the God who made it, we focus on the thing and try to make it our savior from the meaninglessness and hopelessness we wrestle with. And there are surely some in here tonight, like me, who have tried to find ultimate satisfaction in a romantic relationship. And it ended. And maybe you lost hope that ultimate meaning, that sort of ultimate satisfaction is even possible. It's possible. It's possible. The echo of complete satisfaction, of perfect joy, is a real echo. It's a real echo, one meant to lead you to Jesus, where you can finally be at home. So the bride closes her part at the beginning of chapter 2 here by finally acknowledging what the king has been telling her, that she is a rose of Sharon, she is a lily of the valleys. She is something special to him. She's finally starting to gain confidence in who she is in his eyes. And he, in the next verse, verse 2, takes her description and he does a one-up. He said, no, that's not quite good enough. You say you're a lily of the valleys. There are tons of lilies in the valley. You're more than one lily in a valley of many flowers. You're like a lily among brambles, he says. When you're with the other women, you're like a lily and the rest of them are just like these brambles. It's a good thing to say when the ones you're calling brambles aren't listening, probably. But it's just getting to the point of her uniqueness to him, not necessarily others' unattractiveness or something like that. It's throughout the last few verses of chapter 2 that the bride dwells on her sense of utter security. So because of all that has been said so far, she feels utterly secure in the presence of this man. The security she feels comes from his protection, his affirmation, his character, his openness, and among all the other qualities we might list, his clear intentions. There's no public-private dichotomy in this relationship. Like, his attitude toward her in public is a different thing from what he tells her in private. He brought me to the banqueting house, she says. That is, he took her among his friends and his people. He brought her into his group, and he wanted everyone to see that she was his. This was so clear to her and to everyone that he might as well have been planting or carrying around a banner above them that declared how much he loved her. There's no place he's not willing to take her, nowhere he's not willing to walk hand in hand with her, among his family, friends, peers, citizens. He'll make it clear to everyone how blessed he thinks he is. And the cumulative effect of all this, verse 5, is to make her dizzy. She's sick with love. This is a love of mutual attraction and perfect reciprocity. A love where they know they can be fully known and still accepted. A love of unquenchable passion that will soon lead to consummation. Doesn't that sound good? And in verse 7, we learn that this is what we are called to wait for. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. This is the first of three times that she's going to give this warning or this admonition throughout the book. And so it's one we should pay particular attention to. It's one of two refrains that runs throughout this book. And it seems almost out of place at first, right? Because the whole thing so far has just been a progression towards deeper love and more passionate intimacy. And at the moment she is most swept away, where she is saying, I am sick with love, she turns to the chorus of onlookers and she says, don't rush this. Don't hasten this. Love is like a sleeping giant that isn't going to go back to bed very easily if you wake him up. So be cautious that you're ready to wake him up. This love is going to carry you away. It'll make you feel like a twig in a tidal wave. So be sure you're ready to be carried away. It's good to note that the people she addresses this warning to are similar to us. They're in our life stage. So even though this song is centered on the beauty and intimacy, which in Jewish culture could only be experienced in the context of marriage, one of the primary audiences for the book is the unmarried, the singles. She's talking to a group of young but sexually mature women, and she's saying, I want you to hear this. I want you to see the kind of unquenchable passion that I have and that is possible. And I adjure you, literally, I put you on oath. Wait for it. For now, practice unyielding, uncompromised purity. It's so easy to stir up or awaken love, isn't it? It's so easy to take a gesture of kindness as an act of flirtation and to go in your head down the rabbit trail about what you would be like together, about what your wedding would be like, about what your kids would look like. It's so easy to be taken away by someone's interest in you and to ignore all the reasons why getting into a relationship with them might not be wise. It's easy to be blinded by physical attraction and to not see someone's maybe character flaws or deficiencies. It's so easy to get into that deep conversation where you go way too deep, way too fast, and make a commitment you're not ready for. It's so easy to let your desire for intimacy steamroll your desire for purity and end up a mile past where you wanted to be without knowing how you got there. The reason for why the bride gives this warning, why we are asked to wait, is at least twofold. First, she tells us to wait because this type of unquenchable passion can only be obtained through uncompromised purity. as we've noted along the way, the passion she's describing isn't simply physical pleasure. If you want physical pleasure, you don't need to practice uncompromised purity. You don't. But if you want the type of passion she's talking about, that is physical pleasure within the context of unconditional acceptance, you need to practice uncompromised purity. This woman is sick and about to faint with love, not because the king is going to take her into his chambers and have sex with her, but because he is taking her and joining her to himself. And the man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh, says God in Genesis. She is enraptured not by the fact that she's about to experience consummation with the king, which she is, but because she is about to have sex with a man who has respected her body with patience, one who has wooed her to himself with gentleness, one who is about to join her with himself in faithfulness. Her passion is unquenchable because she is about to be his and he is about to be hers. And the only context where that kind of experience can happen is marriage. The only sexual context where she feels like she can let loose and be exactly who she is the context where they've already said to each other, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, before God and these witnesses, till death do us part. God doesn't want us to engage in sexual intimacy with lurking doubts in the back of our mind about whether this person's going to really stick around. Are they going to still be here next week? Is their love still going to be real? If it isn't, what's going to keep their commitment? That's not a context that fosters unquenchable passion. But knowing you'll be loved tomorrow no matter what you do, knowing you'll be accepted no matter what the other person finds out, knowing that you can be naked and not ashamed, that spurs unquenchable passion. Another reason she warns us not to stir up or awaken love is because she knows how much it can skew our perceptions. It's the intoxicating influence of infatuation, right? She calls it, or she compares it to wine. Yeah, that leads us to ignore the doubts that might be in our mind about a person's character or about whether we're really ready to get into something serious. Relationships are something we need to think clearly about. We need to know, does this person have the kind of character that would foster the passion that we were made for? Would they provide security and covenant faithfulness that would lead me to feel naked and unashamed with them? Or would they keep me on my guard and make me feel like I need to perform if I'm really going to be accepted? It's implied in the poem that the couple has already traveled through that stage and come out on the other side. They've already considered each other's character. They've already observed each other and everything's checked out. They've thought carefully about their relationship and whether it would please God. They've traveled through that preliminary stage and they've committed themselves to each other, not in marriage yet, but in betrothal. We're getting to marriage in a couple chapters. With marriage about to happen, they can start to express the passion that they have now, until now, held back with wisdom. You can date somebody and not awaken or stir up love. That's possible. One writer puts it like this: the main purpose of dating is clarity, not intimacy. The main purpose of dating is clarity, not intimacy. If your goal in dating is clarity rather than intimacy, you can keep love asleep for a time while you try to discern if the relationship is wise, the type of love we're talking about here. I mean, intimacy is inevitably going to grow as you get to know someone and click with them. That'll happen. But it's not to be the goal. Clarity is. That looks like setting strong boundaries and having a community to keep you to them. It looks like having an observable relationship where the people who know you best can weigh in. It looks like pursuing God together and asking a lot of practical questions about who they are, where they're going, and what they want. Then if clarity is achieved and everything looks good, it's time to think seriously about marriage. It's time to stir up and awaken love. It's time to clear the way for passion. And as crazy as this might sound to some people, the implication of this is that you probably shouldn't start dating if marriage isn't on your horizon. Dating should be for clarity. Clarity to see whether the two of you should be married. It shouldn't be a holding pattern for years and years. Can that be done? Yeah, it can. Is it wise to intentionally put yourself there? Not in most cases. If you're an underclassman, you should probably consider before you date whether you're being open, whether you're open to being married while you're still in school. It's a viable option if you are ready for it. But if you're not open to that, you really need to think and get wisdom from people about whether it would be a good thing. So uncompromised purity is not like a waiting room we're called into until the passion starts. It's the very method by which we prepare ourselves for the passion that we're reading about in this text. This is why she tells us to wait, because the passion she is enjoying is achieved through present purity. If you really want passion, she's saying to these women, get serious about purity. And real briefly, doesn't it help to think about who's giving us this warning? This isn't some crotchety rabbi who's afraid of intimacy. It's not an early church father who's celibate and thinks sex is somehow a little bit evil. It's not your parents who are afraid of your slipping morality. This is a woman in the throes of love and on the brink of consummation. And she says, wait. It's worth it. God has chosen to give us this warning from a woman we can utterly relate to. She's someone we can trust. So as we close, let me widen the frame on our discussion for a minute. From the biblical perspective, the reason we yearn for intimacy can't be explained simply by biology. We don't yearn for this type of passion merely because of serotonin and oxytocin. The reason this so resonates with us is because the story of the universe and the story of history is a love story. The story that God has been writing since he spoke the stars into existence, and that he will be writing until the wedding feast of the Lamb and the end of all things and when he makes all things new, is a love story between Jesus and the church. Similar to this story, there's a bridegroom and there's a beloved. Unlike the Song of Solomon, the bride that the bridegroom takes for himself is not lovely. In fact, she's an adulteress who's been unfaithful. Jesus is the bridegroom, and we're that unfaithful bride. We're the ones who've walked away from him in order to pursue other loves, the ones who have sinned by leaving the God who made us to find perfect satisfaction in him. When Jesus came onto the scene of history in flesh and blood, he came as a bridegroom in search for his spoiled and lost bride. He came as a lover prepared to win back the heart of his beloved and to join her to himself in faithfulness forever. He did it by living the spotless life that we were all supposed to live, a life of perfect faithfulness to God. He did it by dying in our place, by absorbing the punishment that unfaithful ones like us deserve. He did it by rising from the dead and conquering the power of our adultery. He lived perfectly so that we might be clothed in his perfection. He died sacrificially so that we might die to our unfaithfulness and sin. He rose victoriously so that we might walk in newfound and progressive faithfulness to our bridegroom. Here's what it takes to be a part of the bride of Christ. You have to be radically screwed up. You need to have a deeply unfaithful heart, and you need to know it. It didn't come for the healthy, Jesus said. It came for the sick. That's why prostitutes hung around him. And then you need to believe that because of Jesus' life and death and resurrection, you can be redeemed, cleansed, and made part of his bride. Nobody in here has practiced holy, uncompromised purity, not even close. No one here has waited for sexual intimacy as we ought. Whether you fantasize in your head or whether you sleep around, we've all fallen short of God's standard of faithfulness. But Jesus, our bridegroom, is also our redeemer. And as we trust him, he is cleansing our adulterous hearts and making us back into a virgin bride. One day that's going to mean we'll have no more sin and we'll walk in perfect faithfulness. For now, it means we grow progressively into the image of what we ought to be. We'll grow in our ability to prepare for unquenchable passion with uncompromised purity by his grace. And as we do so, it'll help for us to remember why we're waiting. Because our present purity is setting the stage for our future passion. Because it can only be enjoyed within the context of covenant faithfulness. What are we waiting for? We're waiting for the kind of passion and intimacy that Solomon and his bride enjoyed. And who's telling us to wait? The bride herself, who's in the raptures of love. And ultimately, before and behind her, the God who created sex, the God who's writing a story that is so glorious we won't be able to fathom it until we know it in full, the God who will inaugurate eternity, he'll kick off eternity with a wedding feast and party between Jesus the bridegroom and his blood-bought bride.